Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. If you have any questions or comments on today's episode, please feel free to reach out to me at tom@palisaderadio.com. Joining us today is David Skarica. He's the founder of addictedtoprofits.net. How are you today, David?
I'm pretty good. How are you? Even despite all the crazy volatility in the markets right now.
It's an exciting time. Why don't we start with the thing that's at the top of everybody's mind with the coronavirus?
Well, like, I've looked at a lot of these things because I'm a big student of history. Now, one historical event I always think has been underappreciated or reported on was actually the pandemic of 1918 that happened right near the end of World War One. So, you know, by some estimates, 2.5 to 5% of the world's population died. So one in every, 20 to 40 people died in that pandemic. And some of these smaller South Pacific countries, like 20-30% of the populations died, is unbelievable. And I always thought, why don't people talk about, we all know about the horrors of World War One, but then you had this huge pandemic that wiped out, tens of millions of people, and no one's ever really kind of reported on it. What happened then is it started in a U.S. Army base, and then a lot of those troops went over to Europe, and kind of like this, they didn't have the symptoms at first, and then, when the troops started moving all over Europe, they spread it to other troops in other countries, et cetera. And I don't want to scare anyone because I think one of the big differences between then and now is there wasn't freedom of information then. Remember, World War One was still on, so there was a restricted press in most countries, and the countries in the war didn't want to report on how bad it was because they could say, oh, that's a weakness, right? If the Germans knew a bunch of English soldiers were sick or vice versa, you could actually attack their line thinking that they were weakened because, they had so many fatalities just happening from some sickness. So it wasn't well reported on, which, by the way, is one reason it's called the Spanish flu, because Spain wasn't part of the war. So they actually did have a free press, and they were one of the countries that was first reporting on it in the spring of 1918. And then what happened is it kind of died down, and the first wave of it wasn't that strong in the spring. And then in the fall, when the troops were still being moved, and especially because of the British Empire at the time, Britain was moving troops to not just like just the war, they're moving troops to places like South Africa and Asia and et cetera. And that was, spreading it even more. And then you had people working in munitions factories. And of course, when you have a flu or a virus like this, working in close proximity to other people can also spread it as well. So there are all these factors that led to it becoming just horrible. And the second wave was much stronger. And actually, most of these, flus tend to either kill infants or older people. And that's what's happening at the moment. But the second wave of that pandemic, actually, they called it a W because the spike was actually healthy people in the middle. So killed infants, it killed old people, but also people in their 20s and 30s. So that was what made it so rare. And I think one of the reasons like that, if you think about it this way, one of the reasons that happened was quite simply because with all these people in these army bases being affected, it was mostly young males, right? So, these flus have a way of finding weaknesses in your immune system. So maybe what happened was it kind of found a way to affect the same people that were first, had it and attack their immune system. But anyhow, like I said, the markets actually, believe it or not, rallied in 1918, but had more to do with a relief rally because the war was over. But then there was a kind of a post-war decline from 1919 to 1921, and the markets actually fell quite a bit. And I think the pandemic actually played a part in that because, with all these young males and young people dying, it would have meant less consumer spending, less, activity in the labor market because those are the people that are starting to work and being productive, et cetera. It did have an immediate effect. And of course, the difference is this time is that we've had this huge stock market, bull market / bubble moving into the pandemic. And that, of course, I think has, made it so sensitive to these actions. And of course, even though that was really the first ascent of the global economy in the 19th century into World War One, that's when trade started. We didn't have the airplane or anything then, but people could, ride around on railroads. The car had just been invented, and obviously you could take boats over to Europe, et cetera. So all of the small amount of tourism that occurred at that time too basically died out with that pandemic. So, of course, now it's much more integrated. And I think that's why the market is so spooked, too, because, you know, I live in the Bahamas. This is a tourist-based economy. They've actually just banned people from entering the country if you've been in Italy or Iran or China for the past 20 days, because it takes about 2 or 3 weeks for this thing to, you know, show up. And that's going to hurt the economy here. And, you know, in Italy, where it did happen, that's a classic example. The Italian economy has been very weak the last decade or so. But one of the strong parts of Italy's economy is tourism, you know, and people visiting historical churches and sites and actually just the basic scenery in Italy. So I think that's what's spooking people so much, is that you've got this kind of open traveling and society in the West. And, you know, that now is kind of being short-term closed upon. And actually, the stats show that this year we're going to have a bigger year-over-year decline in air travel than we did it after 9/11. Now, part of the reason was 9/11 happened in September, and you only really had 3 months after that where everything changed, right, where this just started at the beginning of the year. So you've got really a full year of decline. And then to add this, but what I would like to see is – maybe because, you know, the VIX went over 50 on Friday the 6th of 2020. So I would like to see if finally these big readings in the fear gouges at least have a short-term kind of bottom. And actually, last thing, what's interesting about travel being weak is that the Dow transports did not confirm the industrials or S&P 500 on this last bull move. The transports never broke above their 2018 highs. So they were suggesting weakness in the movement of goods, movement of people, et cetera, which is amazing considering that was way before the coronavirus was occurring or on anyone's radar.
How does that tie into the Dow transport, and what's your prediction for the Dow in the coming months?
What it is when they started, there was the Dow Industrials and Transport. And the industrial, you know, back then, think about the 19th century. You basically had two areas of the economy. You had the big industrial manufacturing economy that were making the goods and services. And then you had the transports, which mostly back then it was railroads, which were moving the goods and services. And then obviously the consumer side emerged, and air travel, et cetera, became part of the transports as well. And now the industrials, you know, stuff like Apple are in them. So it's still pretty relevant because the industrials still either have industrial companies or companies that make aerospace goods like Boeing or tech goods like Apple. And the transports, you still need to move a lot of things like oil and gas or other aspects of the economy via rail, via shipping, via airlines, you know, FedEx, et cetera. So they kind of still confirm each other. So I think the transports really underperforming was just a sign that the movement of goods and services wasn't confirming the production of goods and services. And that was, well, you know, one of the reasons the market failed here. And by the way, this has happened in the past. This actually happened at the 1999-2000 top, when the transports actually fell from April 99 to March of 2000, while the market, you know, the Dow, the S&P, et cetera, blew off.
Oil has been down 24% in the last 2 weeks. This is no doubt a combination of the reduction in demand from China and also Saudi Arabia slashing its prices. How do you see the oil price continuing? We're speaking here on March 8th, and I saw earlier today that it's projected that the oil is going to open about $10 down on Monday morning. How do you think that's going to affect everything?
Obviously there was no agreement from OPEC, and we have that collapse in demand due to the lack of travel that I mentioned because of the coronavirus. So here's the thing about that. The market has a way of weeding out the weak, right? It's Darwinian. Now, with cheap money and zombie companies able to stay alive, that's gone a bit by the wayside in the last 10 years. But one of the biggest bubbles, and I wrote about this years ago, like 2015, 2016, but these things always take longer than you think to pan out. What is this kind of fracking boom in the States? And I'm not talking about the technology behind it or the whatnot. It's because it's funded by cheap money. Most of these companies like are just garbage, these fracking companies. They all bleed red. They all have tons of debt. And unlike, you know, we're both from Canada, even with the problems Canada's having with the oil sands right now, the thing about the oil sands is, even though it's higher cost and maybe a little lower grade oil, is that once you get a project developed, those oil sands projects are gigantic and they're good usually for 10 or 20 years. Well, fracking wells is very short term. Like, you got to keep fracking them over, you know, new wells all long time. You know, the lifespan of a lot of these wells is only a year or two, which means that if you're funding it with cheap debt and cheap money, you have to keep borrowing. That's a major issue. And I think, you know, when you're talking about oil being down $10 and maybe if you go into the 20s, who knows, a lot of those frackers, you know, Saudi Arabia, Russia, a lot of their big cap oil companies are kind of like joint ventures with the government. So they're going to be able to kind of stay alive. And I think the frackers are the ones that are going to go. And look, at when it was the Saudis, I think they're about the worst ally in the world you can have on a geopolitical scale. So the thing about them is, you know, I think a few years ago, if you remember, when they upped oil production, that's what they were doing. I think it was 2014. They were trying to take out the frackers back then, and it didn't really work because the global economy stayed fine. Oil stayed in the 50s and 60s. And actually, in fairness to fracking, even with the problems with debt, the cost of production actually did go down for a few years. But in the 30s, these frackers cannot make money. So I think that's what you're going to see now is I wouldn't believe that everyone talks about the talks fell apart, but I still wouldn't be surprised if there was some underhand kind of motive here to just this. They could say this is our chance to get rid of the frackers, you know, and the coronavirus and lack of demand and potentially lower prices could be it.
Rick Rule was recently talking about Sunni and Shia tensions escalating in the Middle East. In your opinion, does this make that area more volatile and make the Canadian oil deposits more attractive in the coming years?
Well, that's another thing, too, is when you look at a lot of these countries fund their budgets with oil revenues, right? Russia does, Saudi Arabia does, but Saudi's a little, I think, worse than Russia in that, you know, Russia has a very low kind of standard of living. So they have a little more flexibility because they're using it to fund a lot of the government functions, but it's not on a per capita basis a huge amount of money, where the problem is, and the ruble is very volatile. So when it tanks, they're getting like the same amount of rubles. You know, the ruble falls 20%, oil falls 20%. They're actually getting the same amount of rubles, you know, for the oil. So I think Saudi Arabia is a place, you know, or a lot of these places in the Middle East, which now have very high standard of living. They can see some definitely like political tensions because if all of a sudden the government in Saudi Arabia says, or wherever in the Middle East says, okay, we have to cut spending by 20 or 30%. Because we're just not getting this, you know, revenue in from oil and gas. And then when people don't get fed, they don't have money, et cetera, that's when you get those geopolitical tensions. You know, if you look at back, going back to the Mongols or the Germans after hyperinflation, that's always the history of how wars start, essentially. That's something, yeah, you definitely, that I would kind of be looking at.
So with all the volatility in the markets and oil tanking, why isn't the dollar rallying?
See, I think what's interesting, that's really interesting because I think part of it was psychology. Everyone was looking for a dollar rally. I find that what happens in the last bear market, if people are bearish, they think it's going to exact same thing is going to happen. One reason I was bullish on gold and kind of got, you know, my you-know-what handed to me in 2008, you know, in gold stocks was because in 2000 to 2002, I was long gold stocks as a way to play a bear market, and they did fantastically while the NASDAQ tanked. But in 2008, they were sold with everything else. And part of the reason was they rallied with everything else from 03 to 07. And I think this time, everyone's looking for a dollar rally because in 2008, there was this spike in the dollar. But here's what I think the issue is with that. Number one is the whole thing with funding currencies. In 2007, 2008, people were borrowing in dollars and then speculating all over the world, speculating in emerging market stocks, speculating in gold, speculating and whatnot. And then when that trade unwinded, they had to essentially buy back their dollars and sell everything else. So it was really just a trade rather than anything fundamental. Well, now Europe has had much lower interest rates in the States until now. And that's important for two reasons. Number one, the euro has probably become more of a funding currency than the US dollar. Because you could go, you know, if you were a hedge fund, even in the States, you know, you could go to a bank in Europe and borrow, you know, at 0.5%, not at 2%. And of course, that 1.5% margin is huge if you're borrowing the money to speculate. So those people are having to kind of unwind those positions. And then the second one is kind of, if you think about it this way, the US, well, the rates weren't high, but you know, when the Fed funds rate was over 2% and the 10-year treasury was 3%, at least there was some return of, on that. where, you know, Germany's long bond was 0.5%, and, you know, a lot of European countries had negative interest rates. So I think also what's happened is the reason for the premium in the US dollar, e.g. that kind of rate spread, now with the 10-year treasury at 70 basis points, has kind of gone away.
In your opinion, David, there's been a lot of different speculation from analysts here saying that there's going to be a melt up versus a big crash. Would you mind defining what each of those will mean and where you think things are going to go?
Well, a melt up can mean two things. It could either mean a kind of speculative blow off, you know, like happened in 1929 or 99-2000. I think we've already had that. I think, you know, even with a lot of fear here, even though I think we're going to get at some point going to get close to a bear market rally, I think that we're nearing that, and we've like completed the first wave down of a bear market, but we had the melt up. But the melt up could also mean like some form of hyperinflation. If you go look at like the Venezuelan or Argentinian stock markets the last few years when they had their hyperinflation, they were some of the highest performing stock markets in the world, just at US dollar terms, because their currencies were crashing. You know, they were actually going down. So that's the same thing where, you know, the same thing happened in Weimar Republic, is that when you have these hyperinflations, the stock markets actually soar, but not in like, they still lose money in real terms. So we could have, I think, a melt up like that if the central banks really, really step in, because they don't want to see asset prices go down. But I think the most probable scenario is probably some form of, you know, bear market or crash the next year to 2 years. And then that is followed in some kind of maybe melt up. So you could have both, actually, because what will happen is you get some crash and short term deflationary, and, you know, and the Dow is down, you know, I don't know, 30%, 40%, 50%. Then the central banks step in, do QE, maybe they even buy stocks and do all kinds of crazy things, and they actually cause the market to go up. But in like real inflation adjusted terms, it's going down. And by the way, that latter scenario is probably the best thing for gold. That's probably better than even some kind of crash in the market, is if, you know, and when the central banks step in, because what happens in those hyperinflations is, like I said, stocks go up, but they don't keep up with inflation, but gold always does. And of course, the gold equities would as well.
Do you think that all the cheap money that the Fed is dumping into the market and the repo market is going to provide that liquidity for the hyperinflation?
I think the repo market had something unique was happening. Like, there were some rumors that maybe a hedge fund in Europe had blown up. You know, we all know that Deutsche Bank has problems. So I think the repo market had more, it was like a purely financial thing where there was some kind of stress at an institution or something going on. And I think what could happen now is totally different. It's more like them buying, it's going to be kind of more like MMT, modern monetary theory, which people don't, if they just quickly what it is essentially it's the central banks funding deficits and spending because, you know, there's no like real buyers for all the debt out there. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at here, is that if all of a sudden Trump or one of the Democrats decides, okay, the economy's weak, let's spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, and they issue those trillion of bonds, and the Fed comes right in there and buys it. And here's what's interesting about this. QE all went into financial assets. That's why gold and silver, a lot of real assets, did not go higher, while, you know, stock markets and art and real estate, things like this soared. But MMT are things at the government level, especially when you have shortages due to the supply chain problems right now that's coming from coronavirus. That's how you get inflation and hyperinflation. Like, look at Venezuela. Venezuela has hyperinflation because they have shortages of goods and services and tons of printed money, right? And that's what happened in the Weimar Republic, et cetera. So if they do MMT and they're like, you know, like they're doing infrastructure projects, you know, and that means they're buying copper, steel, real assets, I think that's where you actually finally get this kind of stagflationary environment. But here's kind of the kicker. We all know it will be stagflationary, but they're not going to report it, right? Like, I'm not predicting like 1,000%, you know, hyperinflation. What I'm thinking is almost a worse stagflation than the 70s, where it really will be 20-30%. But what these guys are going to do is report it as like 6, you know? So, you know, that and that's even worse because people, like I said, the baby boomers are going to retire. They're indexed to inflation on their whatever. They're in Canada, CPP, in the States, Social Security. So, you know, they're going to be getting 5% from the government, and inflation is really going to be 30%. So that's kind of where I see things going ultimately. But you might have this kind of deflationary shakeout beforehand, which, by the way, may be starting right now.
So in a stagflationary trend, do you believe that can negatively affect the gold and silver prices, give everyone a chance to basically rebuy in at a great discount to what we're at even right now, and then follow the bull market back up when everything really does come to fruition?
I think what really, in terms of the deflationary bust first and then going to stagflation, if that's what happened, I think the issue would be is people own gold, like some people own gold, maybe they own stocks as well. And, you know, especially some institutions that say have big tech positions own some gold as a hedge. So if they get liquidated, they have to liquidate gold too, right? And that's why I think when you see these big down days, and you saw a big seller coming on Friday and the 6th, the previous Friday, that's when gold was down, you know, $50 or $60. So I think that's the issue. And even in 2002, forget 2008 when gold tanked, even in 2002, if you go look at July 2002, which is right near the bottom of the bear market, gold and gold stocks were rocketing. And then right when gold got really, really expensive and the whatnot, or high and whatnot, it had this big smash lower in 2002. And I think that was the same thing. It was kind of this liquidation near the end of a big sell-off. So I think when the selling gets really intense, that's when you can kind of see some margin calls, people being forced to liquidate. But here's another note on that. We're not seeing retail money in. The retail money was chasing Tesla, the space, the Virgin Galactic, whatever. And they're kind of frozen right now. This decline has been so fast and so vicious, they don't know what to do. And at some point when they decide to allocate, and it doesn't mean a huge amount, it has to be like 2-5% of their assets into gold and precious metal stocks, that's when you see them zoom higher. And that's what you saw more in like the 2002 to 2007 bull market, was along with other assets, the retail investors were actually buying some gold equities at the time. Even in 2010, 2011, and the rebound after the financial crisis, I remember Jim Cramer recommending an Nickel Eagle on his show. So once we get some retail interest in these gold and gold stocks, that's actually when you can maybe cancel out this kind of institutional forced selling once in a while, and actually gold and gold stocks can continue higher. But I think what has to happen first is retail investors maybe have to get, shaken out of their bubble stocks.
David, what are some other indicators that you're watching other than just the retail investors coming into the market?
In terms of the gold stocks, one of the key indicators that usually you're early on in a gold bull market is quite simply the gold to silver ratio. And that is near an all-time high, meaning silver in terms of compared to the price of gold is extremely cheap. And because silver tends to be smaller, attracts retail investors, tends to be more volatile, tends to move closer to the end of bull moves like we saw in 2011. I think the fact that silver has not really moved and is so cheap compared to gold is, again, just another sign that this is like something in the first or second inning. I'm more of a football guy, so maybe early in the first quarter, something like that, I think, is actually a real telltale system. A signal. And then other macro indicators are like, the Dow to gold ratio, which, with gold at 1700, say roughly, which is where it is overnight, and the Dow at, let's just say the Dow 25,000. Well, you're still talking about a Dow to gold ratio of, about 15 to 1 or so. And that means it's pretty cheap. That, the top in gold and bottom of the market of the early 80s and early 30s, that ratio went to almost 1 to 1. So let's say the Dow had a 50% drop and they meet there or whatever, Dow goes down 30%. I think you meet a 15 or 20,000, and if they do reinflate, like we just discussed, they could meet even higher. So I think those kind of long-term ratios are kind of showing to me that we're kind of very early on. And then just look at the chart. Like if you're just someone who's a chartist, there's quite simply a saying that I've seen Louise Yamada come up with, who I think Palisade has done interviews with her, and she says it's the longer the base, the more the space, meaning the longer that something is compact, goes sideways, builds a base, the longer the bigger they do that, the longer the bull market is. Well, gold basically traded between 1050 and 1350 for 6 years, which is one of the longest bases in any asset. be it stocks, be it real estate, be it like I just precious metals, commodities, I've ever seen in any asset class. So I think the fact that we're coming out of the six-year base means we're going to have a huge long-term move. And again, if you go look at gold, say back in 98, 99, it had a bear market until about 2000, 2001. And that was about a four-year phase. And that basically led to a 10-year bull market from 01 to 2011. So I think we can definitely see something similar to that. Now, as a warning, the actual bottom and gold was late in 2015. We just had a consolidation after the 2016 spike. So if it's, say, like a 12 or 13-year move, you know, we probably already are 5 years into it. But still, that's a long time, right? That's another 7, 8 years.
So when speaking about the gold to silver ratio, it's been years and years since it's been at its, let's say, preferred rate of 25 to 1. Do you think it's still relevant? And how do you go about thinking about that?
Yeah, I think it's really relevant. I think the biggest issue now is silver's getting sold because, you know, the industrial demand problems it's going to have in the short term. But what I think with the gold silver ratio longer term is again, when I talk about retail investors coming in, retail investors prefer silver because, say, they start buying coins, right? Well, okay, if you buy an ETF, you can buy the GLD, you know, for whatever, you know, $150. But if you're actually buying the physical, a coin, a silver coin, you know, after the fees or whatever, it's going to cost you $20. Where a gold coin, you know, I know you can buy fractions of ounces, but let's just say you're buying a 1 ounce coin. Well, that's going to cost you, you know, $1,700, $1,800 now. Well, the average retail investor, some of them can't really afford that or afford a few of them. So I think gold and silver, just that cheaper price level, usually attracts retail people. And then if you go look at the last couple of sectors that have bubbles, like cannabis, like crypto, these are kind of like millennials who have very high risk tolerances. You know, I'm a Gen X guy, and my generation was like that in the 90s with the internet stocks, right? And that's why actually a lot of people I found in my generation participated in the junior mining stocks in the 2000s to 2011 because they were, you know, we were still young. We were like, you know, in our 20s and early 30s, and this was a volatile sector, you know, when you can have a higher risk tolerance. So I think the closest thing to a cryptocurrency or to a cannabis stock in kind of another industry are the junior mining stocks. So I think those, along with silver, and again, silver is volatile too, are going to attract a lot of kind of hot money, people with higher risk tolerances.
Don't you think that things have changed, though, with a lot of silver coming from secondary production?
Yeah, but I don't think that really matters because silver's always investment-based, the demand. I think the whole thing with the production or supply demand is actually, excuse my language, a lot of bullshit when it comes to precious metals. Because if you go look at it, some of the biggest demand supply deficits in terms of a lot of demand and little supply are when actually things are booming and say there's a lot of industrial demand for silver, but there isn't a lot of supply because, you know, there's no mines operating because, you know, nobody can operate at a profit. And then a lot of the times when actually this price is booming is when you have this kind of excess supply because mines can go into their production and the economy is maybe weaker, so you don't have that industrial side of the demand. So I'm not too worried about that. It's really a psychological trade. It's really a contrarian trade. And it's I'm not talking about like, yeah, that was a few months in 2008 when gold and silver fell with the market. I'm talking like, you know, this, you know, the 2000 to 2011 period when the stock market basically fell 30%, even more adjusted for inflation in 10 years, and gold and silver rocketed. So that's really, you know, we've had this big economic recovery in the last 10 years, yet silver, you know, with all the demand been in it, you know, for electronics, other factors, has you know, gone from 50 to 17. So I'm not too worried about the production side. It's more when we get that investment demand. And I think silver more than gold needs the retail investor. You know, gold, you know, has central bank buying, it has funds buying, etc.
Excellent. Is there any other assets you're watching closely other than silver and gold right now?
I think actually oil and gas is something I'm going to watch pretty close here because, you know, we're seeing this big decline in over this OPEC meeting. Maybe this is kind of the last washout for this phase of the bear market. And the whatnot, or, you know, because you understand, 2008, 2001, 2002, there were all kinds of big bear market declines like this, followed by rallies. And we know the central banks are going to come in here at some time. And then, you know, to quickly talk about Corona, I really think that even if there's a second wave in the fall, once we get into warmer weather, just like in 1918, we're going to see they're already seeing the cases decline in China. That's the one thing, too. No one's looking ahead like that. China was the first country to have this. Now we're seeing decline in cases there. And then, you know, which would probably mean that in Italy, U.S., et cetera, other countries, you're going to see decline, especially when we get to the warmer spring. So I think that also could really lead to a relief rally. But anyhow, with oil collapsing like this, again, I think that if you can find producers that are going to be able to survive the shakeout, look for guys that don't have a lot of debt, obviously maybe lower cost, et cetera, or look for leverage plays. Like the drillers, like Halliburton and Schlumberger, aren't going away. And, you know, they're highly cyclical. And if you go look at them, they usually have these like 80% crashes followed by like 500% rallies. So they're great leverage ways to play it. And by the way, I haven't really talked much about oil and gas myself personally, but now I'm watching this decline overnight as we're speaking because of the fallout over the OPEC meeting. Now I'm really starting to get interested.
That reminded me of something I wanted to ask you earlier, David. When we're reading all these things from out of China, and you were saying earlier that there was a media blackout and there wasn't as the free press as it were back in the day in the 30s, where do you get reliable or what you consider reliable information about things like the coronavirus today?
I think it's almost impossible because when I was researching it, I don't know if you remember, but we had kind of an influenza in 2009, 2010. It was minor. It was like, I think that was one of the bird flus or the swine flu. And I actually had a really bad flu in 2010. Like I was sick for a week, lost 6 or 7 pounds. I remember. And now I didn't even realize that this was going on at the time. And now when I thought about it, I was like, you know what? I probably had it. And I was just, you know, I just thought it was a really bad flu or pneumonia or something. I didn't go to the doctor or anything. I just kind of like, you know, tucked it out in bed, you know, for a week. So what I'm trying to say is I don't think we know because a lot of people, because the coronavirus doesn't seem to be that vicious right now, this strain of it, you know, other than for very old people or infants, which is kind of the norm in a lot of these things. So a lot of people are probably just getting sick and think they have the flu. And then in terms of you talking about covering up, yeah, I'm sure China totally underreported their numbers. But the one advantage of being a totalitarian state is that once it happened, they just locked everybody inside their houses, right? And basically, you know, said, you leave, you know, you're going to prison. So, you know, so that's the one advantage where we have these kind of freedom of movement in the West. And in a way, I think we could be worse in terms of underreporting it right now. And we don't really, you know, they did just block off Lombardy, which is a province in Italy where Milan is. You know, no one can leave it now. Try to like hold it, you know, contain it there. But for the most part, you know, nothing has really changed. Maybe there's less people traveling over fears of it, but, you know, nothing's really changed. You know, you watch a basketball game now or you know, I'm a big soccer fan too. I was watching the Premier League this morning. You know, in England, those games are all full. So we haven't really changed any aspects of kind of our society right now. So I don't know. To be honest with you, it's easy to say, oh, China is corrupt and they have this fascist regime or whatever you want to call it, communist regime. It's basically the same thing. But on the other hand, they have more ability to control some of these things because they don't have all the fears about, you know, quote unquote, being politically incorrect or, you know, restricting rights or the whatnot when something kind of like this happens. This is why, by the way, it's the last thing. I'm really interested to see what happens again in the fall. Like if you look at SARS went away. You know, it lasted for a few months and went away. If this is more of a serious influenza, it's probably going to taper off in the summer, which would kind of fit with my idea that there might be a counter rally here or a bear market rally in stocks. And then in the fall, you'll see a big rollover if, you know, it kind of reappears, maybe, unfortunately, hopefully not, maybe in a stronger strain because, you know, because what we're just talking about, governments aren't properly reporting it or taking care of it.
That's an interesting way to look at it. As we wrap up, David, is there anything you'd like to add?
Living on the islands, there's not a lot of nightlife here. It's more of a day kind of place. You go to the ocean, you do this. And I'm a big sports fan, so I'm a big fan of this site. and I've always liked politically incorrect humor. So anyhow, so I love Barstool Sports because it's kind of like the politically incorrect. Actually, my friend calls it the Zero Hedge of sports media. And there's one guy in particular I like. His nickname is the Wonton Don because he actually lives in Shanghai, and he's kind of their foreign correspondent. He travels all over the world. And he's from Boston, but he lives in Shanghai. If everyone wants to see it just quickly, he did a great series where he played with a Chinese-American football team. And so if anyone just looks up Wonton Don and type in like Chinese football, it will show up. And he wrote recently because he was back in the States, I can't go back to Shanghai right now because of the coronavirus. I'm kind of stuck because that's where my apartment is. I don't know how long this thing is going to go on. So I just wrote him in a private message on Twitter saying, hey, why don't you come visit me in the Bahamas? So, and he was like gung-ho on it. So actually today we're talking on the 8th of March. He's coming tomorrow and I'm going to show him around the island and we're going to do some cool things. It will really show the people where I live in the island. People kind of look that up just on Barstool Sports on their YouTube page or his, you know, Wonton Don. You'll probably see those videos in a month or so. So anyway, that's just kind of a side fun thing. Yeah, and your whole life can't be the damn markets. And with Corona, who knows? We'll all be dead in 6 months. You might as well have some fun now.
Definitely something to look forward to, David. Yeah. All right. Thanks for your time today.
Okay, thanks.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?